Good afternoon. I'm Tom Maloney in for Chris Nolte, and this is the Reporters Roundtable Wrap-Up on Regionally Speaking. How's that for alliteration? On today's show, we'll discuss the latest from the State House and the divide between the left and the right with Dan Carden from The Times, as well as the school referendum votes, or lack thereof, this week from Munster, East Chicago, and Lake Station with Carol Carlson from the Post-Tribune and Joe Pete from The Times. All that and more following this update from NPR News here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Good afternoon, and may the 4th be with you. I'm Tom Maloney in for Chris Nolte on this May 4th edition of the Region Reporters Roundtable. I think I got the name fully correct here. Reporters Roundtable Wrap-Up, there we go, on Regionally Speaking. Joining me in the studio is Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore. And, Stephen, good to have you in. And on the phones is... at least joining us right now is Dan Carden, State House reporter from the Northwest Indiana Times. Dan, good afternoon to you.
Happy to be here.
The week that was in the news, Dan, we'll go ahead and get things started with you. The State House wrapped up the session, and you wrote an article back on May 1st. Republicans, Democrats see results of Indiana's legislative session differently. And before we, I guess, dig into the nuances of left and right, let's talk about what they were able to go ahead and accomplish over the first 4 months of the session. Of course, the balanced budget here in Indiana, you can't pass. You have to have a balanced budget in order to go ahead and get anything else done. But pre-K and road funding, I think, two of the biggest successes for this first session.
Yeah, altogether there were actually 270 new laws that the General Assembly approved and Governor Holcomb enacted over the past few weeks. But like you said, road funding is probably the biggest one going to make the most impact, the one that most people are going to notice. It's a little unusual that, you know, we have a Republican-controlled legislature and a Republican governor, and they voted to raise taxes on Hoosiers, and quite a bit of taxes, actually. The gas tax is going to go up 10 cents a gallon on July 1st. So when you see gas prices going up for the 4th of July, they'll be going up a little bit more in Indiana because of this permanent gas tax hike. They also voted to raise vehicle registration fees by $15 a year. So starting in 2018, you're going to be paying a little bit more, but that money is going to go to your local roads, so you're going to get something for it. And that's where that roads bill ended up. It's, like I said, a little surprising that the Republicans push for it. A similar plan in Wisconsin, which is controlled by Republicans, is pretty much dead on arrival. So Indiana legislators have been studying this issue for 4 or 5 years. They saw that there was really no way to do it without new revenue, and they pushed it through.
And they're not able to get that money with the toll road, right? Because sale of the toll road happened, and that, I believe, actually ends May 31st, if I'm not mistaken. Starting June 1st, we'll start to see rises in the cost for the toll roads, which will not go back into Indiana roads. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's a separate thing. So when they privatized the toll road in 2006, they got $3.85 billion up front. They lease the road to this company for 75 years, and the company gets to take all the toll road money. But to be fair, this road funding package that they just passed, it's going to raise about $5 billion in just the next 7 years. So
that's a lot of repaving projects.
I
just made the trip down to Indianapolis yesterday, there and back, and all throughout I-65, a lot of construction happening, especially between our offices here in Merrillville and just past Lowell, and then again over in West Lafayette, where I don't think they've actually stopped construction over the past few years.
Right.
Can Hoosiers, expect more even on the side streets, more road repaving projects, new roads, et cetera?
Yeah, you're going to see a lot of construction. And the stuff you're already seeing, this is stuff that was done before the road funding package. So the project in Lake County to widen I-65 to three lanes throughout the whole county was put in last year before we even had this money. So this money is going to go to a ton more projects. When Governor Holcomb signed the bill, he said that Hoosiers are going to be smelling asphalt morning, noon, and night. And he's pretty eager to deliver on that because he wants people to see that they're getting something for their money in this situation. So,
and you quoted Governor Holcomb saying, in quote, short, the legislature over-delivered. Of course, we've got the workforce redevelopment stuff, road funding, pre-K. So we saw a lot of action at the State House. Is that abnormal to see this kind of work being done and being done so quickly during a first session?
Not necessarily. This session seemed to go a lot smoother than some previous sessions because Governor Holcomb didn't really push the social issues like Governor Pence did. So there was, an annual abortion restriction bill, but it wasn't, you know, as aggressive as Governor Pence did. It basically, you know, required pregnant teenagers to get their parents' permission to get an abortion, or made sure that they had their parents' permission. But, you know, Governor Pence, you know, passed an abortion bill that got struck down as unconstitutional in the courts. So You didn't see that kind of sort of divisive push just to make a point that you saw under Governor Pence. So Governor Holcomb really, And both sides of the aisle talked about this. Even the Democrats said, you know, Governor Holcomb deserves at least a solid B for, you know, working with the legislature, listening to them, pushing a reasonable, achievable agenda rather than some sort of pie-in-the-sky tax cut that the state couldn't afford that, you know, that Mike Pence did. Basically every year he tried to come up with some billion-dollar plan that the state didn't really need or couldn't afford, and sometimes he'd get part of it, sometimes he'd get all of it, and no matter what, he'd claim victory. So,
oh, that's politics for you as a whole.
Right.
One thing I think that was really interesting, going into the session, Governor Holcomb had stated that he did not want to move forward on the legalization of marijuana of any kind. However, he has since signed into law the use of cannabinoid oil for citizens who suffer from seizures. He says it's not a slippery slope. We've seen legislation from Northwest Indiana lawmakers, including Karen Talion, who I should note sits on the board of directors for Lakeshore Public Broadcasting, has tried to go ahead and pass, not necessarily for recreational use, but more for healthcare use. CBD, is this a big deal? Is it not a big deal? What are the thoughts at the State House with this?
It is seen as somewhat of a big deal because it does sort of open the door to acknowledging that there are potentially medical benefits to marijuana-derived products. But this is not medicinal marijuana in the sense that you see it in California or other states. It's, it's limited to, I believe, just children with epilepsy.
Okay.
And there's an extremely rigorous process to get this. You have to have basically tried everything else and have nothing work. And then there's also, you know, there's a registry that you have to get on to get this, and it's a very limited distribution type thing. So you're not going to be seeing like the medical pot shops that you see in other
states. The dispensaries,
right. And you're certainly not going to see recreational marijuana, probably in this state ever, just because, you know, it's a conservative state. I mean, we can't even sell alcohol on Sundays. you're not gonna get pot on the corner store.
That brings me up to my next point, Dan, is once again, Indiana not able to solve issues when it comes to alcohol. Of course, the big thing being a burrito shop of all places inside of a gas station that was using a legal loophole to claim themselves as a restaurant to get an alcohol permit to sell cold beer for carry out, even on Sundays. It's a mess. When are they going to fix it?
Well, this incident, the situation has sort of really crystallized for legislators that it is a mess. Before, they were pretty happy to just sort of let it go on as a quirky thing. But now they're starting to see people, like, you know, real people are like, maybe we need to do something about this. And they're calling their legislator and saying, why do I always have to go to Illinois to buy alcohol before a Bears game? Or, you know, why can't I get cold beer at the grocery store or at a gas station because that's where I buy my alcohol? And, it, you know, it is a mess. You know, Indiana's liquor laws, a lot of them date back to the 1930s. There's a lot of entrenched interest. I mean, the liquor stores have one thing they're pushing. The grocery stores have another thing. There's a fight between the beer distributors and the liquor distributors because the beer distributors want to distribute liquor and the liquor distributors don't want to allow that. So it's a whole, I mean, there's a lot of money involved. There's a lot of, you know, issues involved. And the real challenge will be for the legislators to work out what the best public policy is for the state, regardless of what the big interests want them to do. And that's going to be really tough to do because I think probably the only people who understand all the liquor laws are the liquor interests. So there's a lot of legislators who have just sort of coasted on this, figuring that things were never going to change, so they didn't really need to pay attention to it. And now they might need to pay attention to it and get into it pretty deeply and try and figure out, you know, what is the 21st century alcohol policy for the state of Indiana.
We're not really allowed to go ahead and endorse political candidates with public broadcasting, but I will make note that I will vote for whoever can go ahead and fix this, if only for my Sunday afternoons. We're talking with Dan Carden, State House reporter for the Times. Dan, you also had an update yesterday, not necessarily about the State House, but the South Shore Line expansion and a 5-month federal spending plan approved on Wednesday. What is the status there?
Yeah, the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority, which is leading the South Shore expansion effort with the double tracking between Gary and Michigan City and the West Lake project to bring the South Shore down from Hammond to Dyer, they're going to apply in August for federal funds that would pay for half the project. So they already have the state money that was in the state budget that just got passed. The Westlake money was in the 2015 state budget, and then local communities have committed money to these projects over the years. And so now they're going to go after the federal money. They're hoping to get in the 2019 federal budget, which would be adopted in October 2018. So they're going to apply this August. Their proposal will be evaluated. Then they hope to get into the 2019 budget.
And
the short-term spending plan has $2.5 billion for transit projects across the country. And what that does is it kind of clears the pipeline for the Northwest Indiana projects to get, you know, moved to the top of the list. If these $2.5 billion worth of projects didn't get funded in the short term spending plan, they would have still been on the books, you know, with an earlier claim on federal money than the region projects. And probably more importantly, the spending plan shows that even though President Trump wants to cut federal spending on transportation, cut transit spending, cut these kinds of infrastructure investments, Congress isn't going along with him on that. So they're sending him this spending plan that funds these projects, and that seems to signal that they're going to continue funding these projects in the years to come.
I was going to say that's one of probably several things that the president and Congress cannot necessarily agree on at this point. And Stephen Lattimore joining us in studio. Stephen, I think earlier this week you and I actually talked off air about the city of Gary wanting to go ahead and reduce the amount of money they're putting in towards the South Shore line. Dan, does that information impact what the rest of the cities do, say, and think in terms of funding?
Well, and no. The short answer is no. Merrillville also is trying to get out of paying what it has committed to pay, but a new law passed this year basically enforces those contracts by having the state treasurer intercept any of the money that goes through the state to those municipalities if they haven't made their payments to the RDA.
Dan, this is Steve Lattimore. So they're basically taking it off the top, right?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
And the state has an interest in this because the bonds that will be sold for those projects get sold through the Indiana Finance Authority, And if there's no money backing those projects, that the locals can say, oh, yeah, yeah, we'll pay for it, and then they back out, the bonds will default, and then mm-hmm. the state's left holding the bag, and they're not going to risk their credit rating on that.
I understand how that process works, and I guess for my part, I can't understand, if your municipality and you've agreed to this, you know, you understand fiscal policy. You can't back out of that.
Right. You're already pot committed at this point.
But I do understand, you know, after they, you know, look at their dollars, they realize, hey, you know what? This is going to be a lot. By the same token, this is going to generate revenue, get economic development into your area. How can you back out of that? I don't understand it.
Well, especially with Gary, it stands to benefit tremendously because – yet another new law, the Transit Development District, puts the RDA in charge of developing these areas around the rail station. So, you know, it's not just going to be, you know, an acre of parking lots surrounding a train station. It's
like it is now.
Be housing and business and all of that. That's going to bring new residents and new companies and other projects and taxes. And
that is the crux behind the driving force with all of this, right? Because they want those train stops to become sort of a destination location for Northwest Indiana. Yeah, exactly.
Driver,
so if they can pull the funding but still get the benefit, I think obviously, you know, it's the best of both worlds for any city that can pull that off. But will they be able to pull it off, I guess, is probably the question.
Well, and based on these laws, pretty clearly they won't be. Unless they can somehow negotiate an out with the RDA, which seems unlikely.
Dan Carden from the Times of Northwest Indiana joining us here on Regionally Speaking. Dan, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk about the session that was at the State House.
Happy to do it.
This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney filling in for Chris Nolte and Stephen Lattimore joining us here in studio. Stephen, you and I both had much different weekends covering the same story.
Yeah, we did.
over the course of Friday through Sunday for you, for Saturday for me, the People's Climate Rally. I attended the rally along with Chris Nolte in Highland, and you, meanwhile, boarded a Greyhound bus and headed out to Washington, D.C.
Right. It was a long trip. It was really interesting to see all of those. I mean, you see it on TV, but to see one of those marches, it is unbelievable, especially when you have a turnout like that. Mm-hmm. There are about 200,000 people. It was a sea of people. And it's interesting to be on the ground. I wrote the piece with the idea of what I saw there. What I saw was a lot of mad people, a lot of upset people about what they see as the Trump agenda that's running counter to, frankly, being good stewards of the environment, according to them. Mm-hmm. And then you have each municipality that's making their case for their issue related to the environment. The East Chicago folks went to tell that story, to let folks know, hey, the same thing that's happening in some measure in Flint is happening in East Chicago. And it was a good opportunity for them to put their story on a national stage. And the idea is that they can get with groups and find out stuff that they've done that works, or just to share their story and better deal with it.
And the New York Times reports that Donald Trump's federal budget plan, his quote-unquote skinny budget, if you will, includes slashing the funding for the Environmental Protection Agency by 31%. And you think about that, and it's a third of your overall budget. And we in Northwest Indiana obviously have seen issues with regards to East Chicago,
right.
All these lead contamination sites. Of course, we just recently had the spill on Lake Michigan with Chromium 6 that closed down the lake and the beaches for about 3 days. Is this something that Northwest Indiana can survive or get past? Because we see these photos, I believe it was Time had just released earlier this week a series of photos from the 1960s and 70s before the clean air regulations began,
the
clean
that.
Water regulations
began.
On
the West Coast.
Yeah.
We had a big spill out there.
Right. And what does this mean for Northwest Indiana moving forward if the EPA gets defunded like this? What are the people saying at these climate marches?
Well, the big problem for them is that's the crux of it. You have a certain amount that's already been allocated for Great Lakes restoration, and they're talking about doing away with that, which means when they go out to dig up the ground and the dirt, replace that, they won't be able to do that because the money won't be there. When they want to give them a fair value for their house, they can't do that because the money won't be there. When they want to give money to states for water filters that'll filter out all of that lead, they can't do that because the money's not there. Now, the state can do so much, mm-hmm. but they're also hoping that the federal government will come in and put in whatever they're lacking.
And we saw, speaking of digging dirt out and replacing it, Mount Baldy is finally set to reopen this week, the first time in, I think, 4 years mm-hmm. Since it closed. And there's an issue where scientists literally think it was just decaying trees that the dunes had gone ahead and covered up. And when they decayed, they eventually fell apart and caused a massive hole. A boy 4 years ago fell into it. They found right. him. He survived remarkably, right. an incredible story. But it's things like that that don't even necessarily tie into pollution issues, right, but right. still affect or are still affected by EPA funding. What are the residents? What are the citizens? The activists that you went on the Greyhound bus over the course of the weekend? What are they saying? I guess what is the newest thoughts?
What they're doing is making their case for what they're calling economic justice, and what that is that. They're making sure that people understand it's not just cleaning up the mess. The issue for them is that in these areas that have had pollution basically hidden for 40 years, and now these chickens are coming home to roost, they're realizing that we probably shouldn't have built a housing facility on top of a smelting plant,
right.
and all of the issues that have come out as a result of that. Now it comes time to clean that up, and they're saying, you know what? We don't have enough money for that. Well, they're saying, no, you can't do that mm-hmm. because you're going to basically leave us holding the bag, and we didn't do anything to deserve this. The EPA is there, supposed to be there to safeguard the residents to make sure if there's an issue, they go out and clean it up.
And at the People's Climate Rally in Highland this weekend, one issue, and I don't know if this came up in Washington, D.C. at all, Stephen, but one issue that was brought up was that of race. And a lot of community activists really want to get minority communities in Michigan City and Highland and East Chicago involved, and they're just not seeing that involvement from across the region. So is that something that's ever discussed, I guess, at the national level, the issues of race when it comes to a place like East Chicago?
It absolutely is. Their school of thought by a number of these activists, NAACP has a mm-hmm. has a whole section that deals with that a lot of these issues happen in African-American communities, in black and brown communities, that the dumping goes on there. Now, I actually spoke to Mayor Copeland about that. He said, well, he didn't think that was the case. He thinks that it was just a smelting plant that was there, it shouldn't have been there, and that because of this industrial area, mm-hmm. it is what it is, and we just got to deal with it now. But there's a whole other school of thought that says that may be the case here, but in general,
right.
that black and brown communities
Look
are the ones that deal with all of this.
Yeah. Flint, Michigan, obviously, right. The city wanting to save a couple of bucks
right.
and switch the water source over to the Flint River, which was contaminated, thus causing the lead contamination issues.
And if nothing more, it may be a cumulative thing. I don't know that necessarily they went out with the idea of, oh, here's a brown community, let's contaminate the mm-hmm. water. But I think the cumulative effect is that, okay, one happens and another one happens.
Right.
Then after a certain amount of time, you got a pattern. You say, wait a minute, looks like all of these are happening in areas of color. So.
And, of course, we saw the same thing happen out in the Dakotas, the Dakota Access Pipeline,
right.
and wanting to run the pipeline through sacred Native American, Native Indian lands.
Correct.
And originally the proposal was going to go through a white neighborhood. And they said—
I didn't know that.
They said no. And so that's why it ended up getting rerouted through Native American lands. It's something that we see Flint, Northwest Indiana, the Dakotas— issues abound when it comes to racial tensions, and of course, all being tied in now, remarkably, to the EPA as well as the Great Lakes Restoration Project. Stephen, anything else that happened over the course of the weekend from that trip out to D.C.?
No, that was basically just putting their putting their story out there, making sure that a number of people on a national level heard them. Now, one of the things that they're doing now is what happens after the march.
Right.
And this weekend, they're going to have a big planning session on that. And they're actually going to march at a BP refinery, which they think, obviously, is a big part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
The work. But, you know, the other hand is that, you know, you gotta have something to run these cars. They're
right.
saying we should be moving towards more clean energy, more renewable energy, that we can certainly do that,
mm-hmm.
but we got to do it in a clean way.
And it was a remarkable statistic that I read earlier this week, that Indiana actually has a lot of green energy, more than a lot of neighboring states, Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, Wisconsin. Indiana really is a treasure trove when it comes to green energy. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens there moving forward for mm-hmm. the Hoosier State over the next I would say probably the next couple of months to the next year or so.
Right.
Of course, we've got all those giant windmills right off of I-65
right.
we see. We've got Lake Michigan, and we've got the Ohio River to the south as well. So a lot of water also helping the state of Indiana there. Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio reporter, and I should note Associated Press State Reporter of the Year from Division Two. So, Stephen, congratulations once again. Joining us here on Regionally Speaking. And we spoke about East Chicago, but we'll definitely be coming back to that with the school referendum bills for East Chicago, Munster, and Lake Station. That's coming up along with so much more with Joe Pete and Carol Carlson. This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney filling in for Chris Nolte. We will be back in just a minute. Good afternoon. I'm Tom Maloney filling in for Chris Nolte on the Reporters Roundtable Wrap-Up here on Regionally Speaking. Chris will be back on Monday with a new edition of Regionally Speaking. Joining us now on the studio line is Post Tribune reporter Carol Carlson. Carol, good afternoon.
Good morning.
So we just had votes this weekend, or excuse me, this week, Lake Station, Munster, and East Chicago. And, do I dare say in typical Northwest Indiana fashion, not a lot of people showed up. Munster, on both public questions passed. Lake Station passed as well, and East Chicago voted no. Can we get a brief summary of what each district wanted to do? Munster was asking for a $48.2 million capital projects referendum for technology upgrades and repairs at all its schools. And Lake Station wanted to go ahead and discontinue its bus service if the referendum had failed.
Correct. All three districts, there are two different types of referendums. One is operating referendum, and that's just basically to allow you to continue funding your general fund, which includes salaries and utilities and paying vendors and so forth. Capital projects, of course, is the building of new facilities or repairs to old facilities. And in Munster's case, they wanted to add some technology upgrades to all their schools, as well as make repairs, roof repairs, any kind of mechanical repairs, all fall under capital projects.
Okay, so let's, dig into, first off, the failure of East Chicago. It was voted no, 78%. Percent to 21%. What does that mean?
Resounding.
That is
no in that community.
And that's a community that obviously is fighting an uphill battle with a lot of students transferring out of the school district as a result of lead contamination issues at Kerry Ghosh Elementary, potentially losing a lot of state dollars as well. Arguably, out of the three, East Chicago probably needed it the most, yet didn't pass. Can you give us any indication as to why?
My first indication would be that the residents there feel that they are taxed enough. There's a lot of layers of government in East Chicago and a lot of taxing units. And when that happens, you, as a taxpayer, you're paying more taxes. So I think that the folks there felt like, hey, we're paying enough for our schools. They need to get by with less. That's what we hear.
And now they're going to absolutely have to get by with less. A really challenging situation for Paige McNulty.
Yeah, they did. The General Assembly did approve a loan for them that will help. I think it was $2.5 million that will help with some renovation work. They had to put the Carrie Gosch students over into a middle school that they did some renovations on. So that will at least help with that.
And you say a loan, but you got to pay back a loan.
Right.
$2.5 million is a hefty loan. Is there any guarantee that East Chicago was not going to default on that loan?
Well, I can't say for that. You know, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that their finances are that dire.
I guess we will wait and see on that. But School City of East Chicago Superintendent Paige McNulty issuing a statement after the referendum defeat. Tomorrow begins a new day for our students and our community. We believe and have faith in the future of our schools and all care deeply about our kids and their futures. Just not necessarily when it comes to tax dollars, unfortunately, for the School City of East Chicago. Meanwhile, though, Munster and Lake Station. Lake Station a little tighter than Munster. Munster passing with two resounding yeses. Both for the school tax levy to replace one passed in 2015, and as well as building repairs. The town of Munster moving forward on that. What are their thoughts there?
It's kind of no surprise that it would pass in Munster, maybe the most upscale, highly educated community we have in Northwest Indiana, with the highest per capita income. They understand the value of having a strong school system, mm-hmm. and they're willing to pay for it.
Lake Station, a little bit tighter on their end. Passing, as I'm looking at the numbers here, 54% to 45%. So really tight on the margins in Lake Station. But their referendum passes. So does that mean they don't have to go ahead and lay off teachers and end bus services?
That's pretty much what that means. This is the second time around for this referendum in Lake Station. They tried it in 2015, and it kind of went the way of East Chicago with a resounding defeat. The difference this time, the folks in Lake Station feel that they took their case to the community and educated the community much better this time around than they did the last time, 2 years ago.
And
That time 2 years ago, unfortunately for them, coincided with the criminal prosecution of the mayor of Lake mm-hmm. Station, Keith Soderquist, and the school officials felt that maybe some voters confused the city and the school district, thinking that somehow the mayor was linked to the school district.
Well, I think when it comes to corruption charges across Northwest Indiana, I think everybody probably assumes it's all interconnected in some way, shape, or form.
Well, in their case, it wasn't. The city and the school district are separate entities.
But for Lake Station, it's going to add $5.6 million to the district's general fund over the next 7 years, is what you've reported in Lake Station Munster School's Chalk Up Wins. We're talking with Carol Carlson of the Post Tribune about the school referendums voted on and some passing and, a few passing and one not passing. East Chicago not getting the yes votes. And, Carol, before we let you go, I'm looking at these numbers, and in Munster, 23% of eligible voters showed up. East Chicago, 14% of eligible voters, and Lake Station, 18% of eligible voters showing up to the polls to vote on these special elections. Is this a common occurrence to have such a low turnout when it comes to special elections?
I don't think that there's ever been a case that this was the only game in town, essentially. There was no primary this year with the usual assortment of candidates for elective office. We just had these three referendums. In Lake Station, I know there were signs all over town letting people know about it with the date on it, so there was an attempt to do that, but you didn't have political organizations that you usually have in the primaries, you know, getting the vote out in the precinct organizations and so forth.
And roughly just less than 20% of all eligible voters showed up for the number of precincts, the number of precincts, 66 precincts reporting, but despite 66 reporting, not a lot of eligible voters out there voting for the election, the special 2017 special election for school referendums. Carol Carlson of the Post Tribune joining us here on Regionally Speaking. Carol, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank
you. This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney filling in for Chris Nolte. Stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming up here in about 18 minutes. And following that, Ryan Priest will be in this afternoon for Dan Clark on All Things Considered with local news, traffic, and weather starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Dan will be back in tomorrow. Chris will be back in with a new show for Regionally Speaking on Monday. Coming up here in just a moment following this break, we will talk with The Times' Joe Pete here on Regionally Speaking. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney filling in for Chris Nolte on the region. I keep calling it region because regionally is on the brain. On the reporters' roundtable or wrap up on Regionally Speaking, quite a lot of alliteration. I'd like to go ahead and thank D. Dotson for producing the show this afternoon and making my life a whole heck of a lot easier. So thank you so much to our producer, D. Dotson. And joining us now on the studio line is Joe Pete. Joe, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Glad to be here, Tom, and you can never have too much alliteration.
That's right. Alliteration and puns. It's what we love in public radio. Joe, we got it. We got a lot to talk about, to dig into. So I guess let's just hit the ground running, if you will. Over last week, four individuals were injured in a BP Whiting refinery accident about a day or two after honoring people who have been injured and lost on the jobs in the mills here in Northwest Indiana. That being said, and of course, President Donald Trump talking about wanting to bring back coal and anti-coal people, if you will, say it's unsafe work. Is our refineries and steel mills and the like here in Northwest Indiana, is that becoming unsafe work?
Well, historic. Over time, it's probably been getting safer there. It was Workers' Memorial Day when the accident took place, and they have a big annual ceremony USW Local 1010 in Hammond. And it's when you look back at the loss of life over the past century at the steel mills, it's pretty staggering. There are more than 390 steel workers have been killed. But a lot of that was in the earlier years. It's been falling off. It's fallen off tremendously. It was at the point where they had gone nearly 4 years at ArcelorMittal, Indiana Harbor East without a fatality, like one of the longest stretches they've had in their history. They unfortunately had a death recently at Riverdale with a crane accident. But the work has been getting safer. There's a greater promotion of safety. A lot of these companies will tout safety all the time, even mm-hmm. in their earnings reports. Before they even talk about profit, they'll talk about, you know, we had so few incidents like this last quarter and that type of thing. But the work has become more automated over time. You just have fewer people, but you have tons of hazards at all those industrial sites. You're dealing with, you know, huge coils of steel that weigh more than cars. You're dealing with blast furnaces where it's hotter than the inside of a volcano. There are cranes moving around everywhere. It's inherently dangerous work in an environment like that. And then that's why they wear hard hats and steel-toed boots and, you know, things of that nature. But the accident at Whiting, it's pretty rare that they have an incident like that, but it was pretty serious. They did have to take four people to the hospital. We're still awaiting word on their condition. As far as we know, it wasn't life-threatening injuries, but it's increasingly rare to hear about things like that. But the problem is when they do have these accidents, especially at the mills, they can often be fatal. Like, you know, people don't go home to their families. And that's one thing the USW is really trying to promote. They're encouraging people to report near misses. They're encouraging, workplace safety and all the contracts. That was a big deal with refinery workers at the last round of contracts. They were trying very hard to ensure they had adequate levels of staffing and that they wouldn't be too harried to where they'd be put in positions where people could get, you know, hurt.
And I guess keeping things along the lakefront right now, BP turns a $1.5 billion profit in the first quarter. What does that mean?
Oh, it's things are turning a corner for them. They actually, that's one of the employment there is not as big as at some of the mills, but it's very stable employment historically. But they recently had their first round of layoffs at BP Whiting since, I think, since the 90s. It's extremely rare that they only employ about 1,800 workers. They do have hundreds of contractors, though, at any given time, because they like to kind of keep their... They probably could do more of the maintenance work in-house, but they like to keep the employment levels relatively low. But they bring in skilled tradesmen from all over, you know, hundreds of additional people there. But they unfortunately did have that round of layoffs. The companies have been laying off thousands of people worldwide. The biggest culprit in that, part of it was because of the liability in the Gulf for that massive spill. But then also crude oil prices a couple years ago fell by half. We've obviously been benefiting from it from the pump in the form of lower gas prices, but it does hurt the oil companies. But now the refining margins are starting to pick up again. They are starting to it's good news for the employment stability up there. Although in crude oil, the refining business usually still does pretty good even when crude oil prices are cheap because people are driving more and they're buying more gasoline. They still need to refine more. But BP's business seems to be turning a corner, so it's good for the employees up there.
And on that note, though, we talked about it with your colleague, Dan Carden, the State House. Gas tax is going up just in time for the 4th of July holiday this summer. And is that going to have a long-term effect on people's consumption of gas, 10 cents a gallon?
Usually, the economists would normally say that this would be the time you want to raise prices while it's lower. Because it's not felt as much. And then the prices now, especially as high as they had been, it's to the point where people aren't noticing gas prices as much as they had. Anytime there's a price increase, you know, supposedly it causes, like, you know, people to consume less. 10 cents, it's hard to say. It might have some impact, but it's It might have some impact, but I don't see it having like that big an impact on BP's business. We still have significantly lower gas prices here than in Illinois, and we still get a lot of the business coming across the border.
And I must say I am personally guilty of this. I just filled up the other day for $2.09 at a local gas station in Crown Point, and driving by that same gas station today, yesterday, gas prices had jumped up roughly 25 to 30 cents a gallon, up to about $2.39, and I just shook my head and looked at my quarter of a tank and said, "I'm gonna squeeze it out as long as I can," and I wonder if that's going to be the trend this summer. And of course, the great family road trip every summer as individuals, travel along to different maybe parks and places while they can still get them before they become. Just pieces of land that are no longer necessarily national parks. But that, I guess, remains to be seen when it comes to gas prices and the effects of cost at the pump. We're talking with Times reporter Joe Pete here on Regionally Speaking. I'm Tom Maloney filling in for Chris Nolte. And speaking of vehicles, continuing that trend, Joe, Ford, the motor vehicle company, their profits plunge 38% down to $1.6 billion in the first quarter from $2.5 billion at the same time last year. Long term, is this anything to worry about for people working at the Ford plant on the south side of Chicago?
Unfortunately, it probably is. And it also, it's a huge ecosystem. There's the Ford plant on Haguish just across the border. There's the stamping plant in Chicago Heights. But then we have tons of automotive supply jobs because Ford is just-in-time manufacturing. Like, they literally get the seats that are made in Hammond and Portage, like, an hour before they're installed in an SUV. Like, it's they support like tons of jobs both on the south side and in northwest Indiana for auto parts supply. because they don't sit on it. They don't have any warehouses full of parts. It comes in a truck, and then it's on the assembly line, and it's rolling out in a vehicle. It's a pretty efficient operation they have there. Unfortunately, automotive is a very cyclical business. It has its ups and downs. Ford has really had almost a record run for the past 7 years. They've seen an incredible the record sales, record profits. The workers have really benefited. They get big bonuses of about, 10-12 grand every year now. But the sales seem to have kind of plateaued. They're starting to decline. It's it can't stay at record levels forever. It's going to, go through the down period, it looks like. That could potentially mean, unfortunately, layoffs at Chicago stamp, it would be at the suppliers too, but at the Chicago stamping plant and the Chicago assembly plant. It's hard to say. It's just like they're entirely driven by demand. So if they don't need three shifts, they might send the third shift home. Mm-hmm. They might, reduce their numbers. They've done this during previous downturns, and it's just the way they operate. Usually it's the people with the least seniority that end up being laid off. They do get called back when times are better. Hopefully it's minimal, and it could be coming, unfortunately. I'm hearing employees are kind of concerned about that too.
Yeah, and
if it keeps going down, that's a realistic possibility.
And if the employees are worried and complaining, then chances are it could be on the horizon for them. We're talking with Joe Pete of The Times, business reporter for The Times here in Northwest Indiana. And Joe, before we switch gears to the next subject, I just quickly want to talk about, I'm seeing the possibility of a floating water park in Lake Michigan.
Oh, absolutely. It's a pretty exciting development. WGN was calling it one of the coolest water parks they've seen. It is, it's a German company called Wibbit. They're looking to invest $300,000 in this new attraction, which it's nowhere near the scale of Deep River Water Park. It's more of 100, 140 kids at the same time. But it would feature inflatable feet. It would be anchored to it would be in the shallow water. It would be anchored to the bottom of the lake, and it would feature inflatable obstacles such as slides, trampolines, a dome they can bounce off of, half pipes, roundabouts. Basically, people of all ages would be able to scamper across these attractions. They'd be in and out of the water. Some of it, you jump from one area and it bounces your friends off, stuff like that. Whiting is hoping it would be a big attraction. It really pumped a ton of money into upgrading its lakefront park there. It's really nice boardwalk, really nice, just a beautiful place. But they're trying to bring in more people to enjoy the beach, and they're looking at additional attractions. This is one that they're hoping is going to be able to draw people from across the Chicagoland area. It would definitely give them an advantage over other beaches because, if your family, kids are going to really enjoy the opportunity to, go in slides and that kind of thing instead of just kind of, swimming around or whatever.
And in typical radio host fashion, I've held the best topic off for last and probably not going to give it enough justice here. But with the last couple of minutes, Joe, we've seen a lot of reports out the last week or two about the shifting migration of populations from Lake to Porter counties, LaPorte County losing population as well, a combined total of 2,500 residents from last year. A lot of individuals leaving Chicago, leaving Cook County as well. Northwest Indiana, upper Midwest migration patterns. What's going on here?
Yes, we are seeing, we are getting a big influx of Illinois residents. However, it's not enough to offset the population loss that we've had in Lake County. We're seeing a lot of out-migration. A lot of it has to do with jobs. We don't have the same amount of industrial employment we once did. We have not gained population in Lake County once since 2010. We did have a period in the early 2000s where it there's been an onward steady decline since the 70s, I believe. We're well off the peak. We're still, we're still by far the second largest county in Indiana. But it's the employment situation has really been costing us residents. People get up, they move to the South. It's part of a bigger trend, though, nationally. You've seen a lot of move away from the Midwest and toward the Southwest and the Southeast. to warmer climates and, you know, those places. The Porter County, however, has been growing. They've seen pretty steady ongoing growth. A lot of it is outmigration from Lake County and that kind of thing. But they've been relatively stable. It's just the Illinois residents we're getting, it's not enough to offset the and there's also a move toward South Lake County as well. St. John has more than doubled its population over the last decade. Crown Point, Winfield, those places have been growing gangbusters. The communities that have been kind of losing, unfortunately, in this are the northern cities in Lake County.
Mm-hmm.
We continue to see significant population loss in Gary, Chicago, and so on.
And those residents aren't necessarily moving to or not necessarily staying around in Lake County, but instead choosing to opt out to go find other places. Even our own Steve Walsh moving down to the beautiful Southwest in San Diego a couple of years ago. Better weather down there, especially on a day like today. We're talking with Joe Pete of the Northwest Indiana Times, business reporter of the Times. You can find him on Facebook, and you can also find his work on nwitimes.com. And Joe, the shifting migration patterns, is this common for Indiana right now, or is this specifically a Northwest and Northern Indiana issue? Is Southwest or Southeast Indiana growing?
More than half the counties in the state are not growing. The state has had anemic population growth for forever, but it's primarily driven by the Indianapolis and the Indianapolis suburbs. Specifically the Indianapolis suburbs is where a lot of the population growth is going. But demographers say, like, more than half of the state is kind of stagnant. The biggest problem is, like, the industrial areas, too, like Northwest Indiana, Muncie, Anderson, Fort Wayne, a lot of these communities that have historically relied on factory work, they're not really seeing any population growth because the jobs are just, the jobs have been eroding over time to automation and overseas competition and things of that nature. And we're not alone. Also, the Chicago area lost the most population out of the entire country, out of any metro area. So we're part of that. So, but it's not the problem is not specific to us, though. It's just part of a broader migration. Over the only place in the Midwest that's really been growing was North Dakota, and that was because of they had that fracking boom up there, and then the population base was so low to begin with that any influx of residents is going to look like pretty impressive growth. But you just generally in the country, you've just seen this ongoing shift to people are going to the coast, people are going to Florida, people are going, moving away from the harsh winters we have here in the Midwest.
And Joe Pete, that's where we're going to have to leave it. Thanks so much for joining me here on Regionally Speaking.
All right, thank you very much, Tom.
This is Regionally Speaking. If you missed any of today's episode, you can catch the podcast online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where we're also streaming worldwide. I'm Tom Maloney in for Chris Nolte, and Chris will be back on Monday with a new edition of Regionally Speaking.